Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
What you think you know may not be so. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today we're going to talk about historical misconceptions. So you may have learned something in history class, heard something from a friend, watched it on television, in cartoons or movies, and think you understand the past, but odds are you don't. And I've been fooled by these as well. So we're going to go through seven historical misconceptions, and there's lots of them out there. I could do a lot of future Free For All Fridays just on historical misconceptions, because history is something I really enjoy studying. I did my undergraduate work in history at Arizona State University. I originally thought that I would become a history teacher. That's what I was studying and preparing for, but God took me in a different route, which I'm happy to do, but you can still see my love for history in my history study series on the church. Every Wednesday, I do about 20 to 30 years of church history. I go by about every three popes or so. What's great about doing church history from a Catholic perspective, you just go by the line of popes and you get a nice little bite-sized chunks of church history as you go through. So right now, I think we're coming up on the beginning of the fourth century now. So Council of Nicaea is almost here. Oh, actually, Constantine is almost here. So you can check all that out at trenthornpodcast.com. Be sure to consider becoming a subscriber. Also, if you haven't done so already, be sure to go to iTunes or Google Play. Leave a review of the podcast. That's very helpful. We've been really growing in reviews. I would love to reach 1,000 reviews by the end of the year. I really think we could do it. It helps people to see the podcast is worthwhile. Just go on there. It takes a minute. Leave whatever stars you feel appropriate is appropriate for the podcast. But a little written commentary is always helpful for people as well. And it's great feedback for me to know what I should continue doing on the podcast and what maybe should be dialed back. Now, let us get to seven historical misconceptions. Here's misconception number one: that Napoleon was a really short guy. So Napoleon Bonaparte, the emperor of France, beginning of the 19th century, people always think that Napoleon was a really short guy, that he was like 5 feet tall or 5 foot two. Well, he was 5 foot 2 inches tall, according to the French measuring system of the time. The French had a longer foot than the British did. So he was 5 foot two, according to the French measurements, but not 5 foot two, according to common American standard measurements of the time we have now. Instead, he'd be closer to 5 foot seven. So if you compare him to other world leaders, he's actually a lot shorter than, not a lot, but shorter than many modern American presidents. But he'd be around the same height as Nicolas Sarkozy or Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. So he would not have been unusually short in his time. In fact, at 5 foot seven, Napoleon was probably about 1 inch taller than the average Frenchman of his time. So why do we think he was short? Well, one, there's the French measurement system, which is different from the British system or the modern standard system. But also, there was a cartoon that was penned by James Gilray called Maniac Ravings or Little Bony in a Strong Fit. So I just love like 19th century titles for things. It reminds me of the titles for movies. Like, you know, you have a movie that's released here in the United States, like 2012. Pacific Rim. You know, usually this happens to action movies. Then when it gets released overseas in like China or Korea, you know, when it's released overseas or in India, it's given a lot longer of a title. Something gets lost in translation. So 2012, it's like epic disaster, giant wave conquer movie, something like that, you know, to cross the barrier. So I love that the cartoon is called Maniac Ravings or Little Bony in a Strong Fit. And you can look it up online. It shows Napoleon. And, you know, he's thrashing about, and it's critical of Napoleon that he's just upsetting the world with his conquests. And it shows him flipping over a table and a globe and throwing a hissy fit. And in the cartoon, he looks about the same size as the sofa that he's overturned. So he looks really small. The cartoon's meant to show him look like a child throwing a tantrum. But in the process, it kind of conveys the message that Napoleon is just a really short adult. And so I think that's one of the other reasons that maybe one of the other reasons that within the public consciousness, the idea that Napoleon was short started to take root. Another historical myth, though, this is 1B connected to Napoleon. Napoleon and his armies did not destroy the Sphinx's nose in Egypt. So the Sphinx, you go to Egypt, the creature, it's got the wings and the, you know, different parts of the body. It's got the body of a lion, the head of a human. That people will say, oh, well, Napoleon and his troops blew off the Sphinx's nose. No, that's not true, because you can go back to artistic depictions of the Sphinx before the time of Napoleon, And it shows that the Sphinx doesn't have a nose. You can see artistic renderings of her from the 1600s. So it was definitely long before Napoleon that somebody lopped off the Sphinx's nose. Though back then, the Sphinx was actually buried in sand up to its neck. You could only see its head. You didn't see the lower part of its body. One theory is that a Muslim Sufi named Muhammad Saim al-Dair in 1378 ordered to have the nose blown off or took action against the Sphinx to combat idolatry, you know, in order to promote Islam and, you know, prevent the worship of graven images or idols, things like that. So whatever happened, what we do know is that Napoleon was not responsible for the Sphinx getting a nose job. All right, misconception number two. The Hoover Dam is full of dead bodies. So according to Wikipedia, the Hoover Dam is a concrete arch gravity dam in the Black Canyon of the Colorado River on the border between the U.S. states of Nevada and Arizona. It was constructed between 1931 and 1936 during the Great Depression and was dedicated on September 30th, 1935 by President Franklin Roosevelt. Its construction was the result of a massive effort involving thousands of workers and cost over 100 lives. Originally known as Boulder Dam from 1933, it was officially renamed Hoover Dam for President Herbert Hoover by a joint resolution of Congress in 1947. And you've probably heard, yeah, well, it's true that a lot of people did die during the construction of the Hoover Dam. In fact, the first and last deaths at the Hoover Dam were a father and son. They were related. So strange things do happen. But one thing that did not happen was the entombment of a body or even of several bodies or even a body within the concrete dam itself. How do we know that? Well, we know that because the dam wasn't poured as just one giant block of concrete. In fact, if you were to do that, it would melt the canyon itself because concrete, I believe, is exothermic. You know, if you're a physicist or a construction worker, whoever, engineer, you can correct me, go to trenhornpodcast.com. I believe the term is exothermic, but that when concrete, when it dries, it emits or radiates heat. So you can't pour a ton of it in one setting. So when you're creating the Hoover Dam, they would make a bunch of shallow casings and they would pour the concrete in and let it harden. So it wasn't like there were these giant pools of concrete for people to fall into and drown or asphyxiate in. There was one guy who did fall into the concrete and he broke his back, but they fished him out of it. The other problem is that if you left a human body in that concrete, it would create a void. Eventually, it would decay, it would break down, it would leave air pockets within the concrete, and that would affect the structural stability and structural integrity of the dam itself, which you can't have because it's holding back billions of gallons of water. The dam would be in danger of collapse if it had a bunch of these pockets inside of it that were filled with dead bodies. So, no, there are not a bunch of dead bodies in the Hoover Dam. That being said, though, we're speaking of the Hoover Dam. I've been to the Hoover Dam, I think, once or twice. My family, we drove up to Vegas once. This is back when I was a kid. I went there for a cousin's wedding. And back then, to get to Vegas from Phoenix, you had to drive across the Hoover Dam. And it took forever. Took forever to get across the damn road because, you know, it was just this little two-lane thing. But we did stop and look at the Hoover Dam. And it's impressive to see. Now they have the bypass. There's a big bridge you go across instead. So you don't have to drive across the actual dam itself. And so that reminds me of the scene from Vegas Vacation with Chevy Chase. Vegas Vacation is not a great movie. It's nowhere near as good as National Lampoon's Family Vacation, where Chevy Chase plays Clark Griswold and the Griswolds go to Wally World and John Candy is in it as the security guard. That is a classic movie. It's awesome. Vegas Vacation is, it's okay. It's not super good. It's not terrible, but it's not really very good either. But there is one scene that they go to Vegas on vacation and they go to the Hoover Dam and they take the dam tour. And, you know, here's the introduction to that.
Now, I'm about to take you through a fully functioning power plant. So please, no one wander off the dam tour. And please take all the dam pictures you want. Now, are there any dam questions?
Yeah, we're going to get some dam bait.
Eddie.
This way, please.
So he goes with his cousin Eddie, is played, I think, by Randy Quaid. Randy Quaid? Yeah, I think so. Wow. This isn't the movie trivia hour, so we'll get back to that at another point. But that's what it makes me think of. All right. Number three, the McDonald's hot coffee incident. Do you remember this? There's a lady who spilled the coffee on herself in McDonald's, and she was given $2.1 million in a settlement. This is back in 1992 in Albuquerque. And a lot of people take this as an example of a frivolous lawsuit. Like, oh, you can sue anybody and make a ton of money. And that's ridiculous. You should know, lady, that coffee is hot. And if you pour it on yourself, you might get burned. You know, you get $2 million for spilling coffee on yourself. I should spill stuff on myself all the time. Her name was Stella Liebach. But the thing is, there's a lot of the story that we don't know. That people assume a lot of things. They've heard about it in the media that this was a lady who was out to sue and make a ton of money and just filed a frivolous lawsuit and she didn't get hurt and McDonald's just paid her a bunch of money to hush up about it. That's not what happened at all. Stella Liebach was an elderly woman who went to McDonald's with her grandson. They pulled into the drive-thru. They pull off to the side. The car was not moving, and she had her coffee, and she spilled it. But the coffee was ludicrously hot. It was 200 degrees. Like, it caused third-degree burns. And so, in fact, I'll play you a clip. This is from KRQE, a local affiliate in Albuquerque, because this is where the case originally took place in New Mexico, that went back to it in 2014 and interviewed Liebach's grandson, who was there. And they talk a little bit more about the case and fill it in and show you that the McDonald's hot coffee case, there's a lot you were not told or was misrepresented in the media. So I'll play that.
Pulled into pretty much the same exact spot and put it in park and just started organizing everything we had to do.
That's when Stella spilled the coffee in her lap, soaking her terry cloth sweatpants.
And next thing I know, Grandma started screaming. I looked over and I noticed the coffee cup had tilted over.
Tiano rushed his grandmother to Presbyterian Hospital. In so much pain, she went into shock.
When I saw the amount of skin that was burnt, I was pretty surprised. And then I realized that this was something a little more serious than usual.
Dr. David Arredondo was the surgeon on call.
A third degree burn or a full thickness burn means that the entire layer of skin is burnt through, is gone.
Stella had been burned over 16% of her body. Those so-called minor injuries, they're hard to look at. Third degree burns on the most intimate parts of her body. It took a series of skin grafts to repair the damage.
She experienced third-degree burns in 3 seconds.
Attorney Ken Wagner represented Stella Liebach. So what about the legend of the lawsuit-happy old lady?
She'd never filed a lawsuit before in her life. She was just decent, good people.
Turns out Stella Liebach didn't want to sue. She wanted McDonald's to check the temperature of their coffee to make sure other customers didn't get burned. And she only asked for McDonald's to pay her $10,000 in medical bills. McDonald's offered $800 with no agreement they would adjust the temperature of their coffee.
I'm loving it. That's terrible. It's just like, hi, your coffee gave me third degree burns on my genitals that required skin grafts. Can you just pay for the surgery and make sure it doesn't happen to anyone else? No, lady. Instead, you can have 2 double cheeseburgers and a small fry. There you go. You want an apple pie? That's going to cost you 48 cents. Here's $800 McDonald's offers instead. And it turns out that 700 other people had filed previous complaints at McDonald's saying that the coffee was too hot and that it burned them. So now you, as Paul Harvey would say, and now you know the rest of the story. All right, misconception number four. Shakespeare, the actors in Shakespeare, sounded like refined British aristocrats. So when we think of Shakespearean English, and I have a terrible English accent, I'm not going to go on and on about it, but it's absolutely dreadful. You know, we imagine that Shakespearean actors, when the plays were produced originally, that the actors spoke in this, you know, we think of them, they have this refined British aristocrat kind of style of speaking. But that is not how Shakespearean English was actually pronounced in Shakespeare's time. Because you see, in the beginning of the 17th century, the English accent, how Shakespeare would have been pronounced, would have sounded more like a Scottish lord, or even kind of like a pirate. The history of the English language is a really funny thing. I mean, you go all the way back to the Norman conquest of England in 1066, when William the Conqueror conquers England, and there's a huge Norman influence on England. The Normans are those who were inhabiting northern France at the time, Normandy. And so they brought with them a big change to the English language. So a lot of the English language, while it has a lot of Germanic roots, English also has a lot of French words in it that serve a kind of redundant purpose. So example, I might say, hey, do you want to grab a bite to eat later? But if I want to be more formal about it, I might say, would you care to dine with me later? I mean, what's the really difference between eating and dining? Dining is just kind of a more formal way of talking about it. Or, oh, I'd be great to meet with him later. Oh, but if I want to talk about it in kind of grander terms, like I had an encounter with him. So, you know, there's kind of these more formalized redundancies because of the Normans. But as the English language progressed, still, if you went back to the time William the Conqueror, your English, you would not be understood at that time. Even if you went back to the time of Chaucer, you go back to the 14th century with Old English, you can kind of read Chaucer, Canterbury Tales. You can read it. But the problem is it would be pronounced so differently in the 14th century, you would have a very hard time understanding it, because at that time, the great vowel shift had not occurred. So you have words like house would have been pronounced as whose. The word mode is more like mood. So this great vowel shift, kind of the shortening and lengthening of different vowels, occurred from the year 1400 up through to the time of Shakespeare, through the 17th, you know, the 16th and 17th centuries. And we know, people say, well, how do you know they pronounce it? Not like we found some kind of old cassette tape that, you know, Chaucer recorded when he was reading Canterbury Tales aloud. Well, one way we can do is we look at these manuscripts, look at these ancient documents, and you can see how words are misspelled. And the misspelling of words sometimes reveals their phonetic pronunciation. We do the same thing today, that sometimes we will spell a word how we think it sounds rather than how it's actually spelled, and that reveals to others how we pronounce it. And the same was true with Old English and Middle English, and as the English language progressed. So there's a wonderful video I'll include it in the description of the video at trendhornpodcast.com, sorry, in the description of the episode, of two performers from the Globe Theatre in London that routinely put on Shakespeare's plays. And they've started doing, just several years ago, they started producing Shakespearean plays, but doing it in what's called OP, or original pronunciation. So I'm going to play for you a clip. One of the actors reads from Henry V with kind of more of a modern British accent, and the other will read the same lines, will perform the same lines, but in OP, the original pronunciation of the time of Shakespeare, which you can decide for yourself. It sounds a little bit like a mixture of a Scottish lord and a pirate. So I'll play that now.
Their first example comes from Henry V. Ben gives the modern pronunciation, and David the OP.
O for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
O for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention.
A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene.
A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene.
Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars.
Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars.
And at his heels leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
And at his heels leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment.
Leashed in like hounds, sword and wars of fire, hardy mateys, we can do Shakespeare here on the Bounty.
So like I said, it sounds that actually when you go back prior to during the Great Vowel Shift, Old English, the pronunciation would have sounded more kind of like how people depict pirates in fiction and in cinema talking. So now you know, when you read Shakespeare, try to imagine your Scottish lord or pirate talking to you rather than somebody at Downton Abbey. Let's go to misconception number 5, the bra-burning feminists. You know, if you think about second-wave feminism in the 1960s, 1970s, that women want to have the same rights as men in the workplace, for example, treated equally in society, and so it's part of the women's liberation movement, and apparently women wanted to liberate the most private aspects of their lives, and so you get the common illustration of a second wave feminist burning her bra as part of this liberation. The thing is, that never actually happened. At least it didn't happen on any kind of large scale by any means. Now, there was a protest in 1968 of the Miss America pageant, which has been protested ever since. Now I think it's protested because Miss America, well, you know, people, the protesting in 1968 is about objectifying women. Protests today would be about saying, you're not including transgender women in your objectifying beauty pageant. Like, oh, goodness, the times have changed, right? But the feminists, you know, complained about Miss America with similar complaints that have gone on for the five decades since then, that it's objectifying, it turns women into a meat market, it promotes unrealistic beauty standards. So during the 1968 Miss America protests, there were like 200 feminists who were gathered in Atlantic City, and they threw a bunch of items that they considered to be symbols of, symbols of keeping women under the rule of patriarchy, of oppressing women, corsets, girdles, and bras. And so they threw all these things into a garbage can. Now, the question was, did they set that on fire? No, they did not. Here is Barbara Cutter. She is a professor of women's history at the University of Northern Iowa. This is how she describes the event.
And there, in fact, was some talk, according to the participants, about perhaps lighting the trash can on fire. But that went against fire codes because the boardwalk was wooden, and so they couldn't do that, or the police were afraid it might catch fire. So nothing was burned at the pageant.
So why do we call them bra burners, though, if nothing was burned? Well, a reporter covering the event, Lindsay Van Gelder, made an analogy between the women who are protesting Miss America and the men who were protesting the Vietnam War, and they protested the war by burning their draft cards, which really did happen. And the story was run under the headline Bra Burners and Miss America. The idea here is, you know, bra burner was more of a figurative expression comparing the dumping of bras into trash cans to the burning of draft cards to protest the Vietnam War. But none of the bras were actually burnt at that time. No bras were harmed in the making of this episode of the Council of Trent podcast. Historical misconception number six. This is one that I had thought for the longest time, actually. I thought that Mama Cass Elliot was killed by a ham sandwich. Not that like some ham sandwich, you know, gunned her down in an alley or something like that. But Mama Cass Elliot, who, you know, tragically choked to death on a ham sandwich. If you don't know who she is, born Ellen Naomi Cohen in September 19th, 1941. Later went by the stage name Cass Elliot, also known as Mama Cass, was an American singer and actress best known as a member of the Mamas and the Papas. After the group broke up, she released five solo albums, and in 1998, she was posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for her work with the Mamas and the Papas. She died on July 29th, 1974, and a lot of people say that she choked to death on a ham sandwich. Like, I've heard that mentioned in stories or in jokes, but that's not true. According to a 2014 article, unfortunately, the first doctor who examined her speculated to the press about the cause of death, and that's the version that stuck. I think the police had told reporters there was a partially eaten sandwich found in her room where she had died, and that might have been the cause of her death. But the postmortem accounts show that she died of heart failure. There wasn't any food in her windpipe. She didn't choke to death. So, well, why do people persist this myth that Mama Cass Elliot, you know, choked to death on a ham sandwich rather than just dying of heart disease? I think the reason people think this is kind of sick and cynical. But Cass Elliot was somewhat overweight. So, you know, if she would not be a star today in our thinly obsessed, image obsessed culture that values stars based on their looks rather than their performance ability, because you can always fix anything with auto-tune. Cass Elliott was a little bit overweight, and I think people probably, so it's, you know, you have this one detail and it confirms in their minds this horrible caricature of an overweight person who is in love with food and can't stop eating and just ate herself to death, which is completely untrue. And Cass Elliott is Mom and the Papas are a wonderful band. She's a great singer. I'll play a clip from the Hollywood Palace in 1969. This is her performing there.
That hangs them up.
yeah, you sing it, Mama Cass. So, and that will dispel the myth. Mama Cass did not choke to death on a ham sandwich. She did. She died of heart disease. Though I will say that it is important to say that being overweight or being obese does contribute to negative health factors. So there's always two extremes. There's people who belittle and mock those who are overweight, and that's wrong. Many people struggle with weight, and they would wish that they weren't overweight, but they just it just seems like it's hopeless to be able to lose the weight or to be at a healthy weight you want to be at. And then there are other people, a part of the fat positivity movement, who say that any criticism of being overweight, even validly showing that being overweight contributes to health problems, is some kind of fat shaming. And that is ludicrous. Our goal is to help all people to become healthy and recognize the challenges that occur in our society, a very food-oriented society that doesn't promote health, leads to being overweight, or of conditions where you are a tofi. You are thin on the outside, fat on the inside, because you might be at a healthy weight, but you eat so terribly, which is something I have been guilty of. You know, you can have high cholesterol, you could have high blood pressure, even if you look just fine. So if you're interested, I did a Free For All Friday a while back with my wife on a wonderful book she's read, Bright Line Eating, if you're interested, and I think a revolutionary way to eat in a healthy way to promote healthy weights. But in any case, a bit of a tangent, at least you know Mama Cass Elliott, wonderful singer, wonderful performer, who tragically died of heart disease, did not choke to death on a ham sandwich. And finally, misconception number 7. Nobody during the time of Columbus believed the earth was flat. You know, there's this misconception that Columbus said, I want to sail to America, and the church said, and the people of the time said, no, you'll sail off the edge of the earth because the earth is flat. Nobody in the time believed that. But where do we get this idea? Well, it comes from Washington Irving's 19th century biography of Columbus, which is really more historical fiction than biography. So Washington Irving put it in his Life of Christopher Columbus that he wrote in, I think, like 1825. And that was at the height of, you know, the 19th century free thought movement, the rationalists, the deists who were arguing against religion. And they wanted to paint religious people as ignorant obstructors of the progress of science and exploration. And this continues today in all kinds of movies, especially cartoons. Here's an old Looney Tunes cartoon with Bugs Bunny. And it starts with Columbus in the court of Ferdinand and Isabella saying, I'm going to go and you see, there's the beep there. I actually put my phone on airplane mode, but because it's on internet, it's still, people always find a way to get a hold of me. How do you get away sometimes from technology? It always finds a way to get to you. But here's a clip of Columbus arguing in this Looney Tunes cartoon with King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella.
Round like, round like, round like, round.
Columbo, the world, she's flat.
The world, she's around.
She's flat.
Look, King, she's around like the apple. She's flat like the pancake.
Pasta fazool.
She's around, she's a firm, she's a fully packed. She's around like my head.
She's flat like your head.
And he bangs him in the on the top of that. I love his old Looney Tunes cartoon. She's as flat as a pancake. Pasta fazool. She's round like my head. Bonk, she's flat like your head. That sounds a little bit more like Speedy Gonzalez. they're doing here. Pasta fazool. I guess it's Looney Tunes. It's a cartoon, but people take from this that's what people believed. And then Columbus goes outside and he's mad, and you know who shows up.
Yeah. What's up, Doc?
I'm a disgust. Nobody believes in the world as she's around.
She looks around to me, Doc.
But here's the thing. People had known that the earth was round for over 1,000 years before Columbus. Eratosthenes of Cyrene, for example, long before the time of Christ even, calculated the earth's circumference at about 85% of its actual distance. In 79 AD, the Roman historian Pliny the Elder wrote, "Everyone agrees that it has the most perfect figure," speaking of the earth. "We always speak of the ball of the earth, and we admit it to be a globe bounded by the poles." If you go to science historians David Lindbergh and Ronald Numbers, they say there was scarcely a Christian scholar of the Middle Ages who did not acknowledge the Earth's sphericity and even know its approximate circumference. Andrew Dixon White, in the 19th century, wrote a book on the conflict between science and religion. But even he admits that Clement of Alexandria and Origen believed the earth was round. Ambrose and Augustine tolerated it. And Albert the Great, St. Thomas Aquinas, that they accepted that the earth is a sphere. And as we approach the modern period, we find its truth acknowledged by the vast majority of thinking men. So now you know that what the debate was not over whether the earth was round or flat. People all knew it was round. The debate was over whether how big it was or whether you could reach the New World by sailing west away from Europe. And Columbus thought the world was a lot smaller. He thought that the distance was much smaller for him to traverse and that he could make it there just with his fleet. Thankfully for him, because he would not have, the New World was present where he thought the Far East was. And so he landed in the East Indies in the Caribbean and accidentally discovered the New World, though it had been discovered by indigenous peoples who had crossed a land bridge connecting Asia and North America thousands of years earlier. And maybe we'll cover that in a future episode of the Council of Trent podcast. But for now, I'm glad you were with me today. I hope I was able to clear up a few historical misconceptions for you all. And I hope you will join me next week for our open mailbag session. And pray for us. Our big conference is next week. The Catholic Church, the early church is the Catholic Church. Early church was the Catholic Church. Maybe a few last-minute registrations. You want to quick hop on a plane, come down and see me. I'd love to see you. If you are a patron, supporter of the podcast, or just enjoy listening, and you will be at the conference next week, I hope you will stop by and say hi. Thank you all so much, and I hope you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.